It's just beautiful. It's just beautiful that my voice, especially as a Global South scholar, is also taken very seriously. I'm not there in a very tokenistic fashion. Not at all. Certainly not at all. And to me, that's I really wish that we could sustain the work of JLI, if only for bringing different people together.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Good day, everybody. This is another episode of the special series where we try to put, you know, a focus on JLI, the Joint Learning Initiative on Faith and Local Communities. And it's part of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen, but really with that focus on JLI. And I'm really excited and delighted that we have Jail as our guest of today. So he will introduce himself. Jail, please go ahead.
Hello, everyone, and hello, Maurice. My name is Dr. Jail Cornelio. You may call me Jail. I'm a sociologist of religion. I am based at the Ateneo de Manila University. It's a Jesuit institution, higher education institution in the Philippines, where I am professor of development studies. But I am on sabbatical right now for a couple of months now until the end of July, in fact. So currently, I am here in Louisville. I am at the University of Louisville Center for Asian Democracy, where I am currently writing my book about religion and politics in the Philippines. I'm just so glad to finally get the time to be working on this book and to be also supporting JLI in whatever capacity that we can.
Yeah, that's great. And before we talk about JLI, JL is. So, when is the book supposed to be finished, and what do you hope to accomplish with, you know?
Oh, super. That's a great question. And it's a question that you should not ask academics.
I don't want to jinx anything. Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. It's like asking PhD students, so when are you going to finish your PhD? Right? So don't say bad words. Well, no, kidding aside, it's a serious thing for me. I need to finish the book before I go back to the Philippines by the end of July. My commitment is to turn it into the publisher around July. And I really want to get it done and over with. I'm halfway through it. I've got 3 more months left, three or four more months. And I'm down to my last 4 or 5 chapters. I already have the skeleton and the framework. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's about religion and politics. I'm looking at how religion is different groups, religious groups in the Philippines are claiming the Philippines to be a Christian nation. Mm. And this is a controversial claim to make, to be honest, for one or two reasons. The one reason is that the Philippines is not really a religious nation insofar as the Constitution is concerned. And yet to have so many churches, including the Catholic Church, of course, that continue to claim that the Philippines is a Christian nation. Now, why is that a problem? The problem in the end is that because it's a Christian nation from the point of view of these religious entities, certain liberties, certain civil liberties are curtailed. So to this day, for example, we don't have a divorce law in the country. Mm-hmm. To this day, we haven't passed the anti-discrimination bill to protect the LGBTQ plus and so forth, all mm-hmm. because the Philippines is supposed to be a Christian nation. So that's what the book is about, and I'm problematizing mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And do you think you're writing a very controversial book?
Gosh, in the Philippines, yes, because I'm one of the very few sociologists of religion that really tackle these topics head on. Most of the time, the people who work on religion are theologians or philosophers, and they have a very different approach of here. Whereas in my case, as a sociologist, I'm very empirical. So I have to name them, you know, the churches who are saying these things, the politicians who are associated with certain religious groups who are talking about, you know, why we should not have a divorce law, or why the death penalty should be reinstated. So I have to name them. And in that way, that puts me in a very hot seat as a sociologist. But I think it's a good thing also, because I feel that the Philippines as a society is at the crossroads now, Maurice. Generationally speaking, people's perspectives are changing. And so maybe 30, 40, 50 years down the road, they will look back on this time and reflect, okay, what was going on in 2024 around that time, and really think about why it took a long time for the Philippines to, you know, make these things that other countries take for granted really happen in the country.
Great. So maybe we should do another podcast after you have finished the book.
I'm very happy to do.
Yeah,
that's great. That one, okay. At the drop of a hat, yes to it.
Okay, so that's a deal. Well, the reason that we're talking to with each other today is because you're the treasurer of JLI, and you know, you
secretary, board secretary.
That's true. I don't have enough money. That as the president CEO, of
know,
course.
And I don't have enough money to manage to be the treasurer of the organization.
Oh, it is because, you know, finances are on my mind at the moment.
Of course.
So you're the secretary. I would like to go back a few, you know, I don't know how long, because that's what I would like to figure out. When was the first time you heard about JLI?
Ah, good question. Not too long ago, to be honest. I think this was in the middle of the pandemic. The previous CEO, Kirsten, reached out to me and asked me to join the board, because at the time she was really building a more diverse board that can really ask different questions about the organization. Okay, so that's the formal introduction to JLI. But obviously, even before that, I had already known about the organization through JLI's lead researcher, our former research director, Olivia Wilkinson. She's still very much involved in our organization, obviously. But I had met her in some academic events many years ago, and we do have overlapping interests. She still continues to work on faith-based peace building, religion and conflict in a post-conflict context in the Philippines. And this is one of the areas that I have ventured into in the past couple of years. And so, you know, having met Olivia has obviously also exposed me to the amazing work of JLI.
Well, what do you like about the work of JLI?
Oh, wow. I really hope that this is something that our audience would also pick up and maybe resonate with. JLI does things, spearheaded many of the things that other organizations are now taking for granted. You know, we're talking about decolonization, faith and equitable initiatives, all of these things JLI took a lead many, many years ago, putting religion front and center of development work, recognizing that religion has a place in development work at a time when faith-based organizations themselves were trying to downplay the religious aspect of their work. JLI was very brave, you know, in really interrogating the big role that religion, faith, in effect, is playing in the development field. And I appreciate that, because I think we're also very brave, and this is also evident in our state of the evidence reports, that in some cases, religion is very helpful. In other cases, religion is not very helpful. In fact, this is one new thing that some of our colleagues at JLI and I are working on, you know, with Emma Tomalin, for example, and Jennifer Eggert. We're doing some stuff in different countries, Burundi, Sri Lanka, Philippines, and eventually Brazil. So we're thinking really very seriously about religious role in peace building, development.
So you were also involved with the first State of the Evidence report?
Honestly, no. No, because at the time, by the time that I came on board, the piece was already coming together. So my main role, my only contribution at the time was to really read the drafts and be amazed, you know, at the work that Olivia, for example, has put together. There were several other contributors to the state of the evidence, but maybe eventually I want to be part of that. If not that, the other publications, the other research, you know, activities of JLI. That's where I'm more involved in, you know, with Emma, for example, as I mentioned.
Okay. Yeah, and Emma, we also interviewed for this series. So if the audience did not check that out, they definitely should. Why is the state of the evidence report, why is it important to you?
No, excellent question. Because one of the big things, and this goes back to your earlier question, what the main contribution of JLI is to the development field, we want to know, people are always asking in the development sector if religion plays a role at all, you know, in development work, in humanitarian work, humanitarian action, philanthropy, peace building, you know, DRR and so forth. And if so, is it effective? Mm-hmm. So the state of the evidence unpacks many things related to that. And the most recent, release, I think that was in 2022. Two, if I'm not mistaken, covers a diverse a set of topics, you know, gender, violence against children, environment, women. And so these are areas where faith-based organizations are really playing a big role. And so we want to know, okay, what are they doing? Are they effective? And we do have, you know, we do have evidence to show that, Yep. We don't need to downplay, or we don't need to disregard or to dismiss the centrality of faith in particular for people, you know, especially in the local communities.
Okay. And has our thinking on good practice around religious engagement evolved over the years?
Good question. I will answer that based on what I am now doing together with Emma and Jennifer. I think the thinking has to do with recognizing the big role of small, quote-unquote, local faith actors. Because whenever we think of religion and development, Maurice, and you yourself would be very much aware of this, and our audience as well, that we're normally thinking of, for the most part, of the big organizations, right? You know, World Vision, Islamic Relief, right? CWS, and CRS, your organization also. So we're doing a lot of important stuff, you know, at the global transnational level. But we also, the thinking as far as some of us are concerned is shifting towards the role of local faith actors. What you call local faith actors? These are often the unrecognized ones, the small players, the pastors, the imams, the ustads, and the ministers, or really the church members on the ground. And in many ways, you know, what they're doing has lasting consequences. In our project, we call them hidden peace builders. Hidden because they're often not recognized in the big literature. What we're doing in our project is, hey, let's listen to their stories. What are they doing? What sort of things do they do spiritually, religiously, with their communities? And let's document them. And so that's exactly what we're doing in Burundi, Sri Lanka, and the Philippines. Yeah. And eventually Brazil as well.
Well, that's exciting. To hear, and so there are also the way I envision then the next state of the evidence report, all of that will be, you know, part of the next report as well, all those findings and realizations. Is that correct?
I will let Olivia, you know, really respond to that more concretely, but I imagine that over time, not just the state of the evidence, but also the bigger literature. That's really what we want to do in our agenda, you know, and in our on our team for us, you know, Emma and Jennifer and our partners with World Vision, our local partners in Burundi and Sri Lanka and the Philippines, we really want to look at the role of faith, both the tangibles and the intangibles, especially the intangibles, because we don't really know, you know, what we mean by intangibles, like prayer, for example, prayer or fellowships, you know, people coming together. How useful is that in peace building? Or does it worsen conflict? Or does it enable people to come together, people from different walks of life? You know, those are the questions that we should be asking. And I hope that, and obviously JLI is already at the forefront of that, you know, through the role that Emma, Jennifer and I are playing.
Great. Let us piggyback further on, you know, what you said, the hidden peace builders.
And, yeah.
You know, so I guess it has a lot to do also with the debates around localization and decolonization, you know, to have more voices around the table and to listen to more people and only, you know, a couple. Where do you see these debates about localization and localization go with regard to religions and development in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years?
Excellent. I'm not the first person to say this, but it's just important to highlight the maybe one or two things. You know, number one is the recognition that the power asymmetry exists. You know, to this day, again, big players, right? The big faith-based organizations, humanitarian organizations, are front and center. You know, when it comes to these things, I think the conversation will, I hope, increasingly acknowledge the local faith actors. Who are they? Where they are? And the big roles, the big, you know, activities and things and contributions that they're making in their own communities. That's one. Number two, the role of young people. I think that's also the conversation that again, based on what I know about the literature and based on what we've been doing in our team, also personally as a sociologist in the Philippines, we're increasingly interested in the role of young people. You know, for the simple reason that it's often young people who are marginalized in conversations when it comes to development, post-conflict reconstruction, peace building, and so forth. And yet, Maurice, they're also treated in a tokenistic fashion. Oh, young people should be part of this conversation. Of course, we need to have young people. But when young people participate in those conversations, they're really just sidetracked, you know? They're just they're there, you know, in a tokenistic fashion, sidelined, you know. And we've seen this, we've heard this so many times. So, you know, the post-conflict reconstruction in Mindanao, for example, I don't think that enough attention has been given to young people. And here's the thing, Maurice, right? I mean, what's particularly interesting about, you know, the Philippines, for example, as a context, in spite of all the impact of the conflict on young people, many of them are still fighting for their space in Mindanao. You would imagine that because of all this marginalization, intergenerational and historical, you know, processes of marginalization, that they would be simply giving up. But that's not really the case for young people in Mindanao. These are the Moro youth, you know, Muslim youth in the southern Philippines. And they're still pushing for, fighting for their own space. And I feel that is another, not just scholarly interest, but also really an important conversation that even policymakers, I have to say, will have to deal with. Because as many sociologists, anthropologists, political scientists have been saying all this time, really changing the narrative about radicalization and peace building demands that young people are really part of that those conversations.
No, I'm happy that you lift that up. But my question, though, to you is, and I know that depends a little bit on which context, which countries we're speaking of, but and I've spoken also, you know, with some some young folks in the Philippines, right?
Yes,
so,
yes.
So there is a trend that the younger generation doesn't feel, to be, well, they would not call themselves religious.
Correct.
So maybe still spiritual, but not religious. What type of implication would that then have for the discussions and the developments around religion and development?
Super. This is a great topic. This is a great question, Maurice. You have time for this?
Mm-hmm.
You have time for this already? You're talking to a professor, to an academic. I can go on. So let me warn our listeners. Okay.
Let us imagine that we are in a tower in New York where we are. We have to go from 110 to zero. But there is a limited amount.
There's a limited. Okay. Okay. To be honest, I'm glad that you're bringing that up because, mm-hmm. As you talk to, those were my students that you talked to, right, for your podcast mm-hmm. also, in the Philippines, and this was what I have also documented in my very first book about young people in Catholicism in the Philippines. I already documented that, many young people would prefer to describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, which is not uncommon. This is what you find in Europe. This is what you find in North mm-hmm. America. And Maurice, and this goes back to your question about its impact on development. I think when it comes to being spiritual but not religious, I think young people are predominantly looking for impact, authenticity. Mm-hmm. That's one of the key words that I picked up from mm-hmm. my research at that time. So in the course of my research, I encountered young people who would say they're not active at church, meaning to say going to mass on a regular Sunday, on a Sunday, but they would be happy to volunteer for this organization. Mm-hmm. Sometimes faith-based, sometimes not faith-based. And if you ask them why, because to them that is more Christian, that is the more Catholic thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not a threat. Obviously, some ministers, some people in the church would find that a threat, the watering down of the faith. But maybe yes, maybe no. But as far as I'm concerned, it only goes to show that some of the elements of religion that we normally, that some previous generations would take very seriously, they're not necessarily the most important aspect of being Christian or being Muslim or being Buddhist, for young people today. In my research, young people are looking for impact, for authenticity. And I think it has to do also with Maurice, with what they find as, for the lack of a better term, the inconsistency, or the more heavier word would be the hypocrisy of the church. Mm. Think of sexual abuses and how many churches have tried to hide all of that, sweep that under the rug. And to them, for young people, calling into question, okay, what exactly does it mean to be Christian? Does going to church really change anything? Whereas for them, being involved in volunteerism, development work, that seems to be where they find a lot more authenticity. It's an opportunity. It's not a threat. It's an opportunity for us in the development sector, faith and development sector.
So, Jay, thanks for that explanation. And so what could that mean for an organization like JLI?
Excellent. Oh, I'm so glad that we're finally talking about this. I don't know, because JLI is undergoing a lot of transitions right now, and we're thinking of really about our future. I feel maybe it's a conversation that we should have. Can JLI also be a network of young people? Mm-hmm. Of young people who are very much interested in the things that we're doing at JLI, right? We're doing a lot of learning hubs in mm-hmm. different regions of the world. We're doing a lot of stuff about peace building, and so forth. Obviously, some of us are already working on that as academics, but can they be, right there in the center of what characterizes us, an organization, mm-hmm. Our interest in youth and religion or youth and spirituality in relation to development. I don't have a very concrete set of bullet points for that, but I just feel that it is again one of those opportunities. I say this because I'm also very much involved in other initiatives, some led by church people in the Philippines, and people are always asking about, okay, how do we involve the youth? How do we involve the youth? But, and then when I look at the organizational structure, Maurice, of these people who are asking, what do we do to attract the youth? Mm. There are no young people there. I could very well be the youngest, and I'm no longer young. I mean, I can pretend to be young, but I'm no longer a university student and so forth. I don't know. I mean, this is just something for us in JLI and also for our listeners really to really think about, because for the most part, when we think about young people and faith, we're just still thinking of, or I think many churches are threatened by the exodus.
Mm.
But if we recognize that, hey, young people are, research shows, Maurice, that young people are not leaving the church because they feel that the church is irrelevant. Maybe. But some research shows that, in fact, young people are leaving the church because they feel that they have been pushed away. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, they're looking for spaces of authenticity and so forth. And I think the development sector is one of those big spaces of authenticity. I just put it out there and for us to reflect on, for us in the faith and development sector.
Yeah. Probably it's similar to the discussions around how do you ensure that you expand the table, that the people that you were alluding to earlier, are they part of the discussions within JLI? And similarly, then that's with the younger generation as well. And if not, how do you make that happen? And I do think that you're onto something in, mentioning the hubs. That's definitely a first and important step to include, different types of people within those hubs. Absolutely. And again, I think if the audience who's listening to this podcast are, as a result, are more interested in what JLI is about, they definitely should go to the website and find out more about the hubs. And maybe within your area, you can be part of a hub.
Yes.
Still, Jael, what I'm struggling with is to explain to people, what the added value of JLI is, right? And so, we have had these discussions about what is the elevator speech, although some marketing people claim that there is no such thing as an elevator speech. still, I'm going to ask you to come up with, what is your elevator speech? How do you, if you're asked about to explain what JLI is about and why people should join that community, what do you say?
Good. Elevator speeches are what I also ask my students to be prepared for. These are thesis students, my undergraduate students or graduate students. Imagine that the dean is with you on the lift. And you're going down from the fourth floor to the first floor. You only have three or four floors to explain what your thesis is about, how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna try doing it right now. This is not very easy, but here we go. I think JLI's contribution to the development sector or into the faith and development sector in particular is that JLI takes very seriously and does a lot of things about those aspects of religion and development that many faith-based organizations would like to do, but because they're doing so many things, they can't really actively do. Anwar, our vice chair, this is how he puts it, because some of us in the board, right, where we say that this is our flagship, the statement of the evidence. Oh, that is our flagship. Mm-hmm. The learning hub, for example. But I think Anwar was onto something recently when he said that no, it's not just about the flagship projects per se, but it's also about the things that JLI is doing that faith-based organizations, you know, religion and development organizations would like to do more of, but because they're spread too thin, that they're not able to really pay attention to these things. And one of obviously is one of them is the state of the evidence. But I think the other thing also has to do with faith and equitable, being faith and equitable. Sorry, being fair, fair and equitable, fair and equitable initiatives, you know, that we're doing. And we take this very seriously within our organization, but also in the things that we do. So decolonization is not just an abstract concept for us. It is something that we want to be evident in what we do as an organization. For example, our learning hubs. We know we make it a point that it's not the Westerners, right? Right, or the academics from the Western universities who are really playing the central role there, but really our local counterparts, and it's not in a tokenistic fashion. They're really, really shaping the conversations at the grassroots level. Obviously, a lot of development organizations are doing that, but I think JLI offers, you know, concrete, you know, mechanisms of how we have done this over the years. And so if you're part of an organization, those of us who are listening right now, who would like to do more of you know, faith and equitable initiatives, please consider partnering with JLI.
Jill, the doors of the elevator have opened. We walk out together. I still have some time before I leave the building. What I would like to ask you, can you share maybe an anecdote or experience which best describes your time with JLI so far?
Oh, wow. How I wish, Maurice, that there would be another opportunity for us to come together as board and officers, right? We did this. The first time I joined was in London, and then last year it was in Istanbul. The best part about JLI is that we really take diversity seriously. And it's just so life-giving. One day you're having a conversation with Anwar, president of IRUSA. Another day, I'm seated right next to you in Istanbul, Maurice, and listening to your stories about CWS and your commitment to JLI and how much you're passionate about this. And on other occasions, I'm talking to people like Andrea of World Vision, Andrea Kaufman. And you're all practitioners. And I represent the academe, you know, together with people like Emma and Catherine. Catherine Marshall is a pracademic, you know, practitioner academic. I guess put us all together in one room. My goodness, it's just questions. We ask questions that could only be asked because different sectors are represented, from different parts of the world are represented. And I think that's to me, as a scholar from the Global South, off the Global South, it's just beautiful. It's just beautiful that my voice, especially as a Global South scholar, is also taken very seriously. I'm not there in a very tokenistic fashion. Not at all. Certainly not at all. And to me, that's I really wish that we could sustain the work of JLI, if only for bringing different people together.
You mentioned a couple of names. I would like to ask you, if I ask you to name only one colleague, a partner or a supporter of JLI who best embodies of what JLI is about, who will you name and why?
Gosh, that's a difficult question. I would like to think of gosh, I knew you were going to ask this, but because so many names are on my mind right now. I would say people like Mo, right? Mo, who's our board member from Thailand. I want to recognize his work because he's a influential, you know, figure in the Buddhist community in Southeast Asia, you know, conflict areas. He takes the faith very seriously, Buddhism, meditation. I promised to visit him in Thailand because he's going to put me in a meditation center. I haven't done that yet. He takes his faith very seriously. He takes his development work seriously. And he's very much involved, not just in Thailand, but in different parts of the world. You know, you email him one day, he's in a different country. You email him in another day, he's in another country. And Maurice, if you have, I'm sure you have noticed this, Mo is a very quiet person, right? He doesn't really speak up. He doesn't really talk much. But if you get to talk to him on a more personal basis, oh gosh, he has so many stories about his work. And he, in fact, just at our Istanbul meeting, he gave me a copy of a book that he edited or wrote, documenting different stories of Buddhist work in Southeast Asia. That to me is a stellar example of what, number one, our partners are doing in JLI, but also number two, the reach that JLI has. So again, going back to how we began this conversation, this podcast, that we want to think of religion and development as a field, not just in terms of the big players, but also, I don't know, it's not politically correct to say the small players, because they're also very big in their own ways, in their own communities, right? But the unrecognized ones, you know, the ones that are that often are you know, secondary, you know? And to me, that's what JLI is really about, you know, being fair, being equitable, and really bringing to the surface all these different voices.
Okay. No, and I really appreciate that you, you know, by mentioning Mo, you were also alluding to the fact that he might not speak a lot, but actually I think he listens carefully. And I think, you know, with my listeners know that what I try to do with this podcast is put a lot of emphasis on that and try to become myself a better listener, where I found out that I'm not a really good listener and have a lot of, you know, more practice to do there and training. And I think many of us, actually, to be, you know, we are so often busy with sharing our opinion without really listening to what the other is saying. And I do think that what I appreciate about JLI is it's not, you know, it will speak out if that is required. But I think also as a community, we are a good listener into this whole field of, you know, where we're almost, you know, there's a lot of pushing and shoving about, oh, you know, we have to do this or we do so important work. But that's maybe also then the problem. The challenge that if you are trying to be much more balanced, one of the reasons that many people don't know about JLI and it is important work. So how do you do that and still stay in the spirit of what this organization is about? I would like to, you know, I'm continue to kind of unpack what JLI is for you. And another question that I have for you is, if I ask you to come up with a song or a piece of music, JLI, that represents JLI for you, you know, which song or piece of music would that be and why?
I wasn't sure we were going to get to that question.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's my favorite.
oh, my gosh. I'm not sure our audience would be very familiar with this. And there was a rapper in the Philippines in the 1990s. His name was Francis Zam. And he had a song called Kaleidoscope World. Every color, every you is represented by me and you. And it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, you know, it's one of those songs that he's already passed on. And
what was his name? Sorry, Frankie? Or
Francis M.
Oh, Francis M.
Francis M. Francis M. You know, Francis M.
Yeah.
In this kaleidoscope world. That was such a beautiful way of embracing. And he was ahead of his time. This is 1990s Philippines, right?
Mm.
1990s Philippines. That is one song that you could very well compose and sing and make famous today in 2024 Philippines, because we're becoming more open-minded, you know, Philippine society. But this was in the 1990s. And you have to realize that in the 1990s, the Philippines was just still opening up. I like that song because he was ahead of his time, you know, recognizing how diversity is such a beautiful thing and something to be to just embrace. I think JLI is doing that, you know. JLI is doing that. I mean, it goes back also to the question you had for me just now about what I really like about JLI. And for that reason alone, I hope that the kaleidoscope world that we are constructing, we are acknowledging and we are embracing will continue to be what we are about. And for that reason, I hope that our organization stays on.
Okay. I like that. Could be maybe one of the taglines. You know, while we talk about the branding of JLI and to do a better job there. What I try to do in the regular podcast episodes is always ask attention to the sustainable development goals as well.
Yes.
And, I'm fully acknowledging that it is far from perfect, but I do think that it is, you know, somehow what we have agreed, we're able to agree on as a world. And yes, you know, the participation could still have been better, but, you know, if you look at the whole timeline, it was better than during much better than during the MDGs. Anyway, we have identified these 17 sustainable development goals. We are at midpoint. But on average, we only reach 15% of the goals. And we only have a couple of years more to go, you know, before 2030. It seems because, you know, we are not able to make the progress that we should make, is that JLI's mission is more crucial than ever. You know, that joint learning to really work collaboratively in, you know, these approaches that will help us to create sustainable change. So, yeah, how do you see that?
Oh, wow. Oh, good question. To be honest, it's also a conversation that we're having in my university, Ateneo. Ateneo is a Jesuit university, and we take this our contributions to SDG very seriously because we are among the top universities in the world when it comes to SDG impact, you know, in the Philippines. And in many ways, I feel that those are the rankings that are far more important than, say, all the usual global rankings of universities that are focused on research productivity and so forth. They're important, but I think what universities are also doing are very important in their respective communities. In so far as I bring that up, because I think that we can do a lot more, Maurice, and you will remember even in our previous meetings at the board level that I would always talk about universities, because I feel that that while the academia is represented in JLI, I feel also that there's a lot more that we can do. You know, for JLI universities and things like organizing events, you know, in the Philippines or in Thailand or Soka Gakkai, Nobu, our counterpart there, they have their own university there, Soka University. Those are partnerships that we could really tap into. I bring that up because I feel that universities are important spaces where knowledge production, technological advancement, you know, new innovations are developing. And I feel that JLI can tap into that, you know. Water, peace and justice, you know, building institutions and so forth. Universities are playing big roles on their own. And maybe JLI, again, could start reimagining, you know, what the future might be like for us in relation to universities, especially in the global south.
Great, that's interesting. Yeah, these conversations always go fast, Jael. I still would like to ask, because when I mention about JLI and, you know, that their work, that the organization tries to work on the nexus of religion and development, yeah, I often hear, oh, so you are an interfaith organization. So and a lot of, you know, my team, the colleagues of JLI,
yeah,
are quickly pushing back and say, you know, we are not an other interfaith organization.
No.
How do you see that?
We are not an interfaith organization in the strictest sense of interfaith. You know, we're not about interreligious dialogue. But also at the same time, maybe it's also an interfaith organization, mm-hmm. because we represent different faiths and non-faiths. By the way, I mean, that's another mm-hmm. thing, right? I mean, we've had so many conversations about this already. Like, okay, you know, what sort of partnerships can we have with non-faith, mm-hmm. you know, organizations, development organizations. But anyway, let's just focus on faith. Obviously, we are different faith traditions and faith groups are represented in JLI. I think maybe the qualm that some of us may have about calling us an interfaith organization is that the label itself is associated with certain practices and certain mm-hmm. activities. But in a way, I also feel that, hey, maybe it's a strength just to be able to say that this is an organization that brings people of different faiths together. Is that what makes us interfaith? Maybe. And is it a good thing? Obviously, it is a good thing. But at the same time, we also have to be very clear about what we mean by that. You know, we work with different faith traditions, and we recognize that different faith traditions have their own ways of doing things on the ground, and we want to acknowledge all of that. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work, and let's be honest about that too. Sometimes the power asymmetries prevail. Sometimes faith and equitable initiatives, even if difficult, prove to be far more fruitful in the end. We acknowledge that too. So the criticality, I think, is what is necessary here if we ever decide later on to really refer to ourselves as an interfaith quote unquote community.
And maybe the colleagues that I've heard reacting on that is more like we are not another, we are special, you know. Maybe that's why they push back. Okay, the last question that I have for you is around, you know, JLI is not, for me at least, it's not a network, another network organization. I think it's much more a community of different, you know, where different people come together, you know, academia, practitioners, interested folks. So a couple of quick questions. Do you agree with that it's much more a community? Then related with that is, what does it mean, according to you, to be part of that community? And do you consider yourself to be part of that community?
Excellent. Excellent.
And how do you see your own role within that community?
Excellent. Excellent. Those are many questions. Network is too loose and too soft, if too weak, if you ask me. I think the very name that we carry already should be the brand. You know, we are an initiative. We are an initiative. We're not just a network. We are a group of people who are initiating a lot of things. A lot of things when it comes to faith and local communities. Our raison d'être, our reason for existence, really is really to support, acknowledge, support, build the capacities of even, and learn from the big, amazing, but sometimes unacknowledged, unrecognized contributions that local faith actors, local faith communities are doing on the ground. For that reason alone, I really feel that I am part of this organization. But I have to admit that I'm still relatively new to the organization. And even though I'm still very new to the organization, I feel like there's a lot to be learned from our colleagues from the Middle East, you know, or they're we're building a hub in Southeast Asia, or from Africa, and Latin America, hopefully, you know, and all these different regional hubs. Not many organizations are doing this, Maurice. Not many organizations are initiating these kinds of things. And I feel that it's an exciting thing. But also, I also acknowledge that is where the sometimes the looseness comes into play, you know, because we're initiating so many things. So what exactly are we about? But I mean, if you just put all that confusion aside, you know, I mean, we're an initiative that learns from one another, because we acknowledge that diversity is a good thing, and we also acknowledge that working with local faith communities is a wonderful thing.
You know, before I thank you for today's conversation, Jael, is there any question that I should have asked you but I did not ask you today?
Ha! Good question to end the conversation with. Is it worth fighting for? Is our work worth pursuing? It's not an easy question to ask. I'm glad that you didn't ask it, but now that I am asking it to myself, now I have to answer that too, don't I? Right? You're a difficult interviewer. I believe in it. I believe in it. There's so much that I still have to learn from it. I want to be initiating a lot more things in the context of the Philippines and Southeast Asia, also for JLI, you know. Granted that we're able to address all the problems that we have right now as we transition into what kind of organization that we want to be in the next couple of years. But I want to do something for JLI, with JLI. We already are, to be honest. We already are. You know, I mean, Emma and I are doing a lot of things. Olivia is going to be back in the Philippines very soon. So in a way, we already are. But I want to do more, especially with respect to young people, because I think they're our missing link. I don't know if that's the right phrase to use here, not just for the sake of the sustainability of the organization, but also because I think the future of faith and development really needs to engage, take young people very, very seriously, and how they themselves can play a big role in faith and development.
And Jael, I'm really happy that I continue to be persistent to, you know, to convince you to have you as a guest.
Oh gosh!
So it was a delight to talk with you. I'm absolutely sure that the listeners listen to you with great joy and also appreciate it, you know, your different perspectives. We will talk again as soon as your book is published. So you know when that will be. So thanks a lot with everything you do, for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
And Maurice, I also want to thank you. And if the audience doesn't know anything about it, Maurice is really one reason JLI continues to be an organization worth fighting for, because of, you know, people like Maurice, you know, who really still believes in it. And I want to thank you, Maurice, also for being so committed to the organization. You're not alone in doing this. I'm here with you.
No, and that's definitely, it's a great community to be part of, and I feel privileged. So yeah, thanks a lot, Jael.
Terima kasih.
Oh, sama-sama. Sama-sama. Thank you. As we wrap up today's insightful conversation, I hope it has sparked your curiosity and interest in the vital work of the Joint Learning Initiative on Faith and Local Communities, JLI. If today's episode has resonated with you, whether it's the desire to collaborate, contribute, or even offer financial support to further JLI's impactful mission, we'd love to hear more from you. The JLI's journey is one of collaboration, learning, and making a tangible difference in communities through the unique intersection of faith and development. Your involvement could be a significant part of this transformative process. Whether you're looking to offer your expertise, resources, or are seeking to understand more about how you can contribute, your initiative is invaluable. Please feel free to reach out to us. Send an email to maurice@jlifc.com or contact us through our platform. We welcome your thoughts, questions, and proposals for collaboration. I'll personally ensure that your interest is directed to the right people at JLI, helping you connect with a network of individuals and organizations dedicated to creating a better world through faith-informed development. Thank you for joining us on Walk, Talk, Listen, where each conversation brings us closer to understanding and action. Your engagement doesn't just end with listening, it begins here. Let's continue to be part of this remarkable journey together. Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.